This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 6, 2013, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, thousands fill the streets in Caracas to mourn the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder faces questions about the use of lethal strikes against terror suspects within the U.S. And we'll go to Gaza, where doctors are conducting the first kidney transplants for residents inside the coastal strip. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. An Egyptian court today suspended national elections by canceling a decree by President Mohamed Morsi calling for polls in April. Opposition parties in Egypt had opposed the elections and threatened to boycott. This comes as protests continue in Port Said, where earlier this week demonstrators burned a government building. International media report hundreds have been injured and as many as six people killed over the past several days of clashes with police. The protesters are demanding that the government release prisoners convicted for involvement in a stadium riot last year. Thousands of Canadian university students were back in the streets of Montreal last night, once again protesting a planned increase in tuition rates. There had been months of relative calm as a new provincial government took over power and promised to keep tuition rates low. According to Canadian press, the premier announced a 3% tuition hike at the end of an education summit last week. Last night's protest resulted in dozens of student arrests. Los Angeles County health officials continue to mobilize to fight a recent outbreak of tuberculosis among the city's homeless population. Citing the health risks, officials are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow it to resume the practice of disposing of personal property left, even temporarily, by people who have no permanent place to store their possessions. Homeless advocates say the city is using the disease as an excuse to violate constitutional rights of due process and protection from unlawful seizures. FSRN's Larry Buell has more.
The city of Los Angeles is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling prohibiting random sweeps of belongings that homeless people leave behind on public sidewalks. The city claims an immediate public health threat, saying unattended belongings create a breeding ground for vermin and bacteria and increase tuberculosis risk for sanitation workers and the homeless population. Officials say TB has killed 11 in the last 5 years and infected as many as 4,500 people on Los Angeles' Skid Row. But homeless advocates like Becky Dennison, co-director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, say no one has died of the disease since 2011.
It seems pretty clear that the story was released by somebody else, not public health, in order to create some hysteria prior to the city filing an appeal to the Supreme Court so that they can be able to steal people's personal property. There has absolutely been a lot of misinformation in the press about the TB outbreak.
The LA Public Health Department says TB cannot be spread through items such as clothes, dishes, or food. If the High Court takes up the case, it may set precedent for similar property rights struggles in other cities. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
The Maryland Senate today voted to abolish the death penalty. The legislation is being pushed by Governor Martin O'Malley. Now it will go to the House. If approved there, Maryland would become the 18th U.S. state to outlaw the practice. Lawmakers in St. Paul, Minnesota heard testimony today on new pro-labor legislation being considered by the state. The Employer Lockout Accountability Act would charge a penalty to an employer that initiates a lockout and would extend unemployment benefits for the duration of any such action. Democratic Representative Joe Atkins is the lead author of the legislation.
Entities come in with big promises of job creation and stimulating the economy and then take our money, only to turn around and do the exact opposite. Lock people out, not let them work, cause unemployment to go up and unemployment benefits to skyrocket.
The legislation partially grew out of one of the longest work stoppages in recent Minnesota history. The lockout of union workers by American Crystal Sugar has been ongoing since August 2011. But Atkins says the practice has become widespread.
We've seen lockouts all over the place, from the high-profile ones like the Minnesota Wild to the chamber orchestras now at St. Paul Chamber and the Minnesota Orchestra, to perhaps the worst one of all, which is the Crystal Sugar situation.
The lockout legislation would also restrict public subsidies for certain organizations that engage in employee lockouts. Today's hearing was before the House Labor Committee. And finally, U.S. Representative Bernie Thompson is asking the FBI to investigate the recent murder of an openly gay mayoral candidate in his Mississippi district, according to the AP. Police found the body of Marco McMillian last week. His family said his body had been beaten, dragged, and burned. Police have charged a suspect in the case. Mississippi hate crimes law does not cover sexual orientation, so if a hate crime is suspected, the federal government would have to step in and prosecute. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Thousands filled the streets of Caracas today to mourn longtime Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez, who died Tuesday from cancer. Chavez was first elected president in 1998, and in his nearly 15 years in leadership, he established popular education and health programs and redirected the country's oil wealth from multinational corporations such as ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. In 2002, Chavez was briefly removed from power in a coup that was supported by the administration of then-U.S. President George W. Bush. While Chavez was admired by many on the left, watchdog groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists criticized him for restricting media and using threats and harassment during last year's election. For more, we're joined by Virginia Lopez in Caracas. She's a journalist with The Guardian. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, Dorian. How are you?
Good, thank you. The body of Hugo Chavez was brought from the military hospital today and through the streets of Caracas. What has the scene been like today?
Well, very early on, it was quite calm. I think people were still soaking in the news of, this tremendous charismatic leader's death. But slowly throughout the morning, they started gathering at the military hospital. And now, like you said, President Chavez's body is being escorted through the streets of Caracas to the military academy where he was once a student. For a sort of a three-day wake where Venezuelans will be able to stop by and pay their respects. The streets are absolutely crowded. Everybody is wearing the traditional sort of red beret that Chavez made so emblematic. It's been a super emotional day, people crying on TV and obviously on the streets. Also, the first regional leaders have begun to arrive. Argentina's Cristina Kirchner and Uruguay's Pepe Mujica are here, and loads more are expected to be arriving in the next couple of hours. Regionally, too, the outpour of emotion is quite impressive. Dilma Rousseff in Brazil declared a three-day period of national mourning. In Argentina, the similar thing has happened, and flags are being flown at half-mast. So again, just to give you an idea of how wide Chavez's reach was, even regionally.
You describe the powerful emotional response, not just within Venezuela, but also in the region. He was in power for nearly 15 years, and during that time, he vastly restructured parts of Venezuela, especially in the areas of education and healthcare, making them more accessible to the country's poor. Are these types of social programs likely to continue, or could they change now that he's gone?
It's more likely that they will continue in their current form if Maduro wins the upcoming election, because of course Maduro is, Chavez's preferred heir and certainly sort of like, the carrier of Chavez's legacy. But Enrique Capriles, who's likely to run against Maduro, also spoke of giving the social programs a continuity when he was running for elections in October, which he lost to Chavez. There's also a sort of a looming economic crisis that experts are predicting in the next couple of months. So it could be that these social programs are also hit by a certain economic cuts that need to be implemented. So again, you know, I think if anything, it's just a period of incredible uncertainty.
You mentioned both Nicolas Maduro, who's now the acting president of Venezuela. He was vice president under Chavez, and also Enrique Capriles, who's seen as the most likely candidate from the opposition. An election is set for within a month. How is that likely to shape up, and what are the factors at play there?
Yes, the constitution says that a snap election must be held within the next 30 days. And Minister of Foreign Affairs, Elias Hawa, has only reiterated that that is the plan to follow. I think it will be a short campaign, clearly, and with a short campaign, usually what happens is that the government's candidate is favored by, you know, by sort of the benefits he enjoys from the support of the government. You know, but Venezuela is a place that continues to defy logic, so anything could happen. But as it stands, that seems to be the likely outcome.
Virginia Lopez, journalist with The Guardian. She joined us from Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
FSRN brings grassroots, independent voices to a nationwide audience, and we've been doing it as a worker-run collective for more than a decade. But this daily newscast and the voices you count on to bring breaking news, analysis, and the human aspect of international stories could go silent in less than 2 weeks. FSRN is facing closure, but there is still time to make a difference. Please visit our website, fsrn.org, to learn more and find out how you can get involved. That's fsrn.org. A planned Senate vote on the nomination of John Brennan to lead the CIA was derailed today when Kentucky Republican Rand Paul launched a filibuster to demand more transparency from the White House on the targeted killing drone program. The senator's filibuster came less than an hour after Attorney General Eric Holder told the Senate Judiciary Committee that the U.S. could use lethal force against terror suspects within the U.S. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details on Capitol Hill.
A letter from Attorney General Eric Holder released this week claims that it's possible for the government to kill a U.S. citizen in the U.S. without trial if it's an extraordinary circumstance in order to, quote, protect the homeland. Several members of the Senate Judiciary Committee grilled him on this point at Wednesday's oversight hearing.
So it leaves many questions for Americans about when the government can kill them.
That's Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley. He criticized the Justice Department for refusing to give members of the Judiciary Committee the legal memos justifying the targeted killing drone program. Holder released some of these memos to the Intelligence Committee this week after members threatened to filibuster the nomination of John Brennan to lead the CIA. Lacking access to this information, Grassley and other lawmakers, including Texas Republican Ted Cruz, repeatedly asked the Attorney General what the government thinks it can do with drones.
If a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil is not posing an immediate threat to life or bodily harm, does the Constitution allow a drone to kill that citizen?
I would not think that that would be an appropriate use of any kind of lethal force. You would expect
with respect, General Holder, my question wasn't about appropriateness or prosecutorial discretion. It was a simple legal question.
I would not think that in that situation the use of a drone or lethal force would be appropriate because the possibility...
General Holder, I have to tell you, I find it remarkable that in that hypothetical, which is deliberately very simple, you are unable to give a simple one-word, one-syllable answer, no.
Holder later told the committee that the government has no intention of carrying out drone strikes within the U.S. and that it's hard for him to imagine a situation in which that would occur. But when Senator Cruz floated the idea of passing a bill banning drone strikes within the U.S., Holder said the bill would unconstitutionally infringe on executive power. Constitutional lawyer Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee disagrees. He says applying the government's authorization of the use of military force to the United States would violate the Constitution's 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments.
It really reflects an extension of the kind of attitude toward executive power that people were very concerned about under the Bush administration. That sort of power, unchecked authority to assassinate Americans without trial, albeit in rare circumstances within the U.S. And then this testimony today about the AUMF having domestic reach, there's no way that they're compatible with the five amendments in the middle of the Bill of Rights.
Other civil liberties and human rights advocates say they hope the heightened attention to the possibility of drone killings in the U.S. brings more attention to the killings already happening abroad. Robert Naiman with Just Foreign Policy said Wednesday's hearing exposed the administration's legal double standard for drone strikes.
In the U.S. context, imminence is clear. The person is a threat right now, immediately, and we have no choice but to use physical force. But overseas, the Obama administration is redefining the word imminent to mean something else. People have been hit in their house or their car. I don't think even the United States would deny that that's the case.
Concerns about drone strikes abroad and the prospect of drone strikes in the U.S. prompted Republican Senators Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and Ted Cruz to launch a multi-hour filibuster Wednesday, delaying a vote on John Brennan's nomination to lead the CIA. Brennan, an architect of the targeted killing program under Presidents Bush and Obama, would oversee the CIA's use of drones if confirmed. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, we continue our coverage of the challenges facing Palestinians in the occupied territories who need medical care. Hundreds of people suffering kidney failure in the Gaza Strip are able to get twice-weekly dialysis in local hospitals, but local officials say 20% of them who are in urgent need of transplants have had to seek treatment in places like Cairo. That can often be difficult as Palestinians need to apply for a travel permit to go abroad. But new developments might mean more surgeries can be performed locally. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more on the first kidney transplant surgery in Gaza.
...36-year-old Nadia Matouk is still recovering from surgery. During a seven-hour procedure at Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital, Nadia donated one of her kidneys to her husband Ziad, who was born with just one kidney.
Last year, we had the most difficult moment as Ziad wanted to do dialysis here at the hospital. By then, I was determined to donate him a kidney. So we moved to Egypt's Nasir Institute, but we couldn't have the transplant surgery. Then we headed for another Egyptian hospital, Adoke Hospital. Yet they demanded $15,000 before they do the transplant surgery. But of course we could not afford it, so we had to return home.
After the family returned home, months went by until they were finally contacted by their doctor in January, informing them that transplant could be done locally. The UK-based Liverpool University Hospital runs the kidney transplant program at the Gaza Hospital. Dr. Abdel Qader Hamad began coordinating the program and was part of a team of physicians from both Liverpool and the local hospital who performed the first transplant surgery in the Gaza Strip.
I mean, we have to bring some equipment with us from Liverpool to do the transplant here. We have to bring some of the medications, which is not available here, with us to do the transplant. And we try to have a proper preparation because I think it is important to maintain the same standards as we have in the UK for the patients in Gaza. To provide kidney transplantation for the patients in Gaza is an important step to make sure that patients have the best available treatment for kidney failure in Gaza itself.
According to the Gaza-based Health Ministry, there are at least 120 patients in Gaza who urgently need kidney transplants, but Gazan hospitals lack the necessary equipment, professional training, and funds to meet their needs. Dr. Muhammad Al-Kashif is Director General for International Cooperation at the Gaza Health Ministry.
For a patient to make a renal transplants, kidney transplants outside Gaza, this was costing $40,000 to $50,000. In addition to waiting a long time until it is achieved, the sustainability of this service, inshallah, will continue, and we will prepare all the infrastructures needed with support of our friends and in support to our solidarians all over the world, so that we will have an independent tissue typist and surgeons to do such a service.
He says that the United Arab Emirate-based Charitable Works Society has supported two other kidney transplant surgeries. The medical collaboration with Liverpool University Hospital is not the first such effort. Dr. El-Kashif says that cardiac surgeries have been successfully undertaken at Gaza hospitals with the help of international medical professionals. Still, each month, hundreds of patients, including those with cancer, chronic disease, and kidney failure, are referred to hospitals outside of the territory. Doctors say they hope to expand the transplant program to other organs of the body, but doing so depends on the availability of funds. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
This is FSRN reporter Zach Brophy in Beirut, Lebanon. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories about the crisis in Syria. I've reported from the ground in Aleppo and have also covered the spillover of the conflict into Lebanon, from the influx of refugees to kidnappings. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how you can support independent grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. Global stories, local voices. FSRN is an investment in independent news. Again, you can learn more at fsrn.org.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison for more than 30 years, most of that time on Pennsylvania's death row. His conviction in 1982 for the murder of white police officer Daniel Faulkner has been widely criticized by groups such as the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, and the UN Human Rights Council. A 2000 investigation by Amnesty International into Abu-Jamal's case concluded that the court proceedings violated minimum international standards of a fair trial and noted significant legal problems, including how the jury was selected and Abu-Jamal's lack of access to adequate counsel and resources for his defense. Amnesty also cited disputed testimony and conflicts of interest by the presiding judge. A new documentary film, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal, explores Abu-Jamal's career as a journalist and his commitment to independent media. FSRN recently spoke to Mumia Abu-Jamal in a rare phone interview from SCI Mahanoy Prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal, welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
The pleasure is mine.
Your career as a journalist begins early in your life as a teenager with the Black Panther Party and its publications, then as a national radio correspondent, and then as a president of Philadelphia's Association of Black Journalists. What first drew you to journalism?
Well, the same forces that kind of drove me to the party. I remember a young sister, older than I, but quite young, who gave me a copy of the Black Panther newspaper. And, you know, I didn't know such a thing existed in the world. And to read the words of these young people, it was like a lightning bolt, you know, to consciousness. It was, you know, this is the 60s, so to actually see that kind of fire and rebellion and resistance, oh, it was like, it was like Christmas in July. It was wonderful. That kind of information really kind of charged me. And when I got into the organization, because I could, you know, read and write a little bit, they put me in the ministry and I began doing leaflets and pamphlets. And before long, I was shipped out west to work on the paper. And I've always enjoyed, you know, that kind of radical and revolutionary journalism.
And you became an editor yourself with the party.
Well, I worked under the editor. Judy Douglas was her name, and she would critique my work and, you know, correct it and give me pointers. And, you know, it was, I never went to J school or journalism school. I went to the Black Panther School of Journalism. And I think it was the best option for any journalist who really wants to write out of the struggles of real people, because that's what we did. I mean,
and throughout your reporting in the 1970s, you covered a wide range of topics. You're well known for your coverage of MOVE in Philadelphia, but you also covered things such as the visit from the Pope to the U.S., the policies put in place by then President Jimmy Carter. For you, what made a good story?
I think a good story is the very heart and essence of journalism. And what that meant is, does it touch and tell a story about the human condition? Is it reflective of real life lived by real people, as opposed to the projections of the rich, the powerful, the government, and so forth? And, you know, I tried to keep an ear for the poor, the oppressed, the homeless, those people living in the projects like I did for most of my life. And those are the stories that kind of rang with me, because I think they speak to real life, real people, and it touches the human heart and resonates.
I'm Dorian Marina with Free Speech Radio News, and I'm speaking with noted journalist, author Mumia Abu-Jamal, also the subject of the new film Long Distance Revolutionary. He's talking to us on the phone from SEI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal, listeners of FSRN and of Prison Radio know your weekly commentaries, which cover a wide range of topics. Can you talk about the process of how you compose your weekly commentaries and the practical obstacles you face in getting them to the air?
Well, it began, I think, as written columns that were published in some papers across the country. And when I was offered a contract by NPR to do commentaries for their show, we literally kind of went into the studio in a prison, of course. We had a non-contact visiting room that for 2 days became a recording studio. And, you know, we had a wireless mic. Noel Hanrahan conducted many of the takes from written columns. We had a producer from NPR, and we worked roughly, I think, 5 or 6 hours a day, and we got a lot of work done. Well, when NPR kind of caved in, luckily Pacifica, and then a few years later Free Speech, stepped up and said, well, if they won't use them, we will. So, you know, God bless them, and more power to them.
We've been speaking with noted journalist, author Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's also the subject of the new film, Long Distance Revolutionary. He was speaking to us from SEI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Want to move.
You can listen to an extended version of this interview on our website at fsrn.org. The film Long Distance Revolutionary is playing in theaters in Los Angeles. It will open in Oakland on March 8th and then in Philadelphia in May. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. FSRN's unique daily newscast of grassroots voices from around the world faces closure in less than 2 weeks. Join us to help keep these vital voices on the air. Visit us at fsrn.org to find out more. Thank you for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.